It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Tis the time for gatherings. It's the season of friends, foods, and fun, and lots of ways to pull them off, like how Chef Michael Solomonoff does it.
I want it to look like a party, so I like a bunch of little salatine, whether that's like raw tabbouleh, bowls of hummus and piles of bread, and then bowls of like different pilafs or grains or Persian rice that's sort of fragrant with saffron and dried fruits and almonds. And then, you know, I like the whole sort of lamb shoulder that's been glazed with pomegranates, whole roasted chicken, pickles, and, you know, people rolling up their sleeves and sort of bumping elbows and passing things and taking little bites and even double dipping sometimes with their spoons and forks, to me, is a good party.
Feasting, the art of port, and in the kitchen with Nigella Lawson, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Britain's Nigella Lawson stepped away from her journalism career in 1998 with her best-selling book, How to Eat. Smart, funny, and beautiful, she's a food writer that writes about the pleasures of food and the ways that cooking can be not only delicious, but therapeutic. Her latest book is Simply Nigella, Feel-Good Food. Nigella, great to have you back with us.
Lovely to be back.
You know, looking at this book, and I got involved reading it, and I realized this feels so personal to me, the reader. And there's this pervading sense of calm in the book. This just feels so intimate. It feels like, you know, we're restoring ourselves together. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, I think that writing about food and talking about food is always intimate. I think we all have a very intense and personal relationship with food. And as long as a writer is being honest and authentic, we always sense that. And I enjoy the conversation around food. And because of that, I allow quite a bit of time to talk at the beginning of each recipe so that it's a bit like settling down. You know, I want to settle down with the reader and talk. And in my mind, there's a conversation and a response. But I think all my books are personal, and I do feel that the recipe is for me, is a very highly charged autobiographical form. It's like a diary entry. The recipes I cook and then write about, it's almost like writing a journal. It feels like that.
Well, the recipes read like that. You say that when your first book came out, the editor branded it in her mind as being, what was it, the masala?
The pea masala and rhubarb cookbook.
Yes. And you say this one is the cold-pressed coconut oil, ginger, chili, and lime cookbook.
It is, although actually there's an awful lot of extra virgin olive oil, which I regard as the elixir of life.
Well, I have to say, this is a quartet that I, too, am addicted to. Let's talk specifically about some of the things you do with it.
Well, I add it to soups. For example, I've got a sweet potato, orange, and ginger soup, because much as I adore a sweet potato, I find that unmediated, the sweetness is too much. So citrus and that heat of ginger is just perfect. And I also love the sort of fuzzy nubbliness of an old-fashioned chickpea soup that perhaps is not heavily seasoned. Mm-hmm. I thought I wanted to bring a bit of brightness and light to it. So I added some of the flavorings of maybe like a Thai hot and sour soup. And I again added lime and chili and ginger. And I also found this wonderful way of getting ginger to be even more dominant, which is I peel my ginger and I use a teaspoon for that because, you know, if you use a knife, you just waste most of the ginger
root.
And then I grated it and then put it in a bit of paper towel and made a little swag bag, like making a tea bag, I suppose, and then squeeze. And this incredibly intense ginger juice comes out. So even though I might grate ginger and put it in a soup, at the end, if I want to add more, I just make this ginger juice. I also use it, you know, I've got a bundt cake that's cider and five spice. So it's a bit like gingerbread, only with slightly more of a perhaps aniseedy licorice note because the five spice does that. And also an awful lot of fresh ginger. The fresh ginger really adds a different sort of heat. It's somehow rounder.
Mm-hmm.
So it can be used in sweet and savory. And, you know, I have to really think of a reason why not to use it.
You mentioned something that sounds delicious, but something you mentioned about cooking yourself strong.
Yes, I think for me that I find the act of cooking itself restorative, but it has to be very simple because at times when I'm either overworked or stressed or generally depleted, I don't really want to feel I've got to concentrate so much and worry about whether I'm doing something right. So a little light stirring, maybe some chopping, but generally something that is cooked quickly and I suppose has ingredients in it that make my body feel strong and full of good things. And for some reason, my body told me to eat sweet potatoes, and I obliged. But also quite a bit of broccoli, cauliflower. I started roasting chickpeas and cauliflowers, or really more baking them together. And once you have cooked cauliflower in the oven, there is no turning back.
These
simple rituals of just chopping a cauliflower, tossing it in a bit of oil and spices, putting it in the oven, and while that's in the oven, opening a jar of harissa and turning some chickpeas and some sliced up tomatoes, and then adding that.
Mm.
And then I'm getting myself ready, I'm calming myself down, I'm feeling ready for my supper, I can smell it. And then I just make a simple warm salad with, I use parsley, like a salad leaf, flat leaf parsley as a garnish. And then, because I think beauty is important in terms of how one feels in life generally and in the kitchen, a bit of aesthetic uplift never goes amiss. And sprinkling pomegranate seeds and that tang.
Mm.
And not only do I have supper, but I have enough left over for lunch the next day. And that's important too. I think that, you know, we're aware that cooking for others is an act of generosity or kindness, but it's really important, I think, to be generous and kind with oneself. And that, for me, was an essential part of making this book.
Tell me your feelings about the term clean food.
Well, I feel that I sound like I'm getting rabid on this, but I don't like the term clean eating or clean food because I hate the notion that's implied that other forms of eating are dirty or shameful. I hate food shaming. I also think that no one makes a good decision out of negativity, so you make people feel bad about what they eat. It's just going to compound the issue. And obviously, I agree that eating real food and not processed food is good and better for one. But I do feel that a lot of clean eating is too restrictive in its approach. There are so many foodstuffs taken out that it becomes a very narrow-minded and almost self-persecuting way of eating. But I don't really have anything against the food itself. I just don't like it if I think there are punitive implications either mm-hmm. to oneself or to other people. I think that food is there to be celebrated, and by celebrating food, we celebrate life. And if you try and take that away or erode that in any way, then life and oneself, you know, we are both diminished.
Nigella, thanks so much for talking with us.
Always a pleasure, Lynn.
Nigella Lawson's latest book is Simply Nigella, Feel Good Food. She left us with a recipe for warm cauliflower and chickpea salad. And you can find it, you know where, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern coined that phrase road food with their first guidebook to America's down-home eats. Now, that was in the 1970s. Well, they're still at it, unearthing dynamite local finds for their website, roadfood.com, and for us. Jane, Michael, welcome back, guys. What's up?
What's up is what may be the most wonderful cup of hot chocolate anywhere. This is hot chocolate as served at L.A. Burdick. It's a candy store in Walpole, New Hampshire. Actually, with branches in New York and Boston, but the Walpole, New Hampshire is the main one. They make a hot chocolate there that really is the most chocolatey thing I've ever had. I mean, it's made with simply, you know, chocolate shavings and steamed milk. It's like a steamroller of chocolate. I mean, one large cup, it's almost impossible to drink the whole thing unless you also have a lot of their Gugelhopf and Linzer Tort on the side to kind of balance it.
You know, on the way to the studio, because I knew we were going to be talking about hot chocolate, I stopped at three franchise places along the highway whose names I will not say, and I got a hot chocolate. And I am truly ready to drive to Walpole, New Hampshire at the moment, because once you've had one of these velvety chocolate concoctions, nothing even satisfies.
Well, what's nice is you can get either the milk chocolate version, which is like unbelievably creamy, you know, very Swiss in nature, or you can get the dark chocolate version, which is, I mean, it's like a steamroller. It's like if you love chocolate, this is nirvana. Because it's so intensely chocolatey. Honestly, I had a large cup. I couldn't finish it.
And not super sweet, which is...
No, not at all.
It's wonderful.
So, do they have other things other than hot chocolate?
Oh, yes. Great pastries. They have Gugelhopf, which is that classic Austrian-Swiss bundt cake. Very perfumey with lemon and vanilla, and it goes beautifully with coffee or hot chocolate. They have very good cherry danishes, and they have Linzer Tort, which, again, is something you can find in pretty many bakeries, but you don't find the wonderful version with the freshly made raspberry jam and rich with flavors of hazelnuts and almond, vanilla, cinnamon, cloves in the shortcake pastry.
Yeah, the pastries and the hot chocolate, and they have espresso drinks as well. It's all very sophisticated, but in fact, it's a small-town chocolate shop. As sophisticated as the products it makes are, it's a very cozy... You know you're in Walpole, New Hampshire when you're eating here.
And you eat there, right?
Oh, yeah. They have tables. You know, it's a tea room is what it is. And there are tables set out with... they have, like, you know, brown paper cloths so they can, you know... get the dripped hot chocolate off very quickly.
Do you remember, Michael, what the girl at the counter said to you when you walked in?
No.
She said, have a mouse on the house.
Ah,
yes. She gave you a little chocolate mouse to eat, which was adorable.
Sounds like a great place for sugar shock.
And chocolate shock as well.
Hey, thanks, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
You can find Jane and Michael's picks at splendidtable.org. Coming up, the art of Spanish chef Ferran Adrià and serious celebrating Israeli style. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media.
Splendid Table is brought to you by All the Chickens at Locally Laid Egg Company. Producing high-quality, delicious eggs for over a decade, Locally Laid prioritizes good lives for their hens. Locally Laid Egg Company also partners with rural farmers to keep agriculture clucking along in Minnesota. Locally sourced, locally sold, that's Locally Laid. You can learn more about visiting the flock at the farm's Airbnb at locallylaid.com.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. The name Ferran Adrià has become synonymous with titles like the world's greatest chef, culinary genius, the father of molecular gastronomy. He's the man who brought foam to the restaurant world. More important, he first started rethinking how we experience taste. And he did this during the years that he ran El Bulli, the restaurant on the remote Catalonian beach that became a culinary mecca. His work transformed the art of cooking into the art of food. So it's not far-fetched that Chef Adrià's work has been turned into an international art exhibition called Notes on Creativity. The exhibit is built around the hundreds of notebooks that he and his team filled with ideas, collaged photos, and sketches of the, would you believe this, 1,846 new dishes created at El Bulli. Our producer, Jennifer Russell, talked with Ferran and his interpreter at the Minneapolis Institute of Art.
It is such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you.
So here we are in this gallery, in this beautiful exhibition filled with your work. How do you want people to experience this? What do you want them to learn about you and your work?
Lo que quiero es que la gente reflexione.
What I want is for people to reflect on it, to
la
think.
Gente casi nunca, reflexiona de que
people hardly ever reflect on the fact that things have been created in cuisine. No. Anything that we eat was at some point created. Everything no, o sea, does.
Los dibujos estos que están aquí,
these pictures here?
Aquellos era para visualizar.
Those were for visualizing.
Desde el Big Bang.
From the Big Bang
al Neolítico,
to the Neolithic.
Toda la evolución que ha habido en la comida, en la cocina.
The whole evolution that there has been in food and cuisine.
O habría un momento de duda en cuándo
empieza. So we can't really agree, or there would be certain doubt as far as deciding when is it that cooking starts.
Se va a su casa y come una manzana, mano, y se la come, ¿eso es cocinar?
So if you go home and you eat an apple, is that cooking?
Para mí no.
For me, that's not.
No, porque no hay la actitud de cocinar.
Because there's no aptitude as far as cooking goes.
Puede ser gastronomía.
That might be gastronomy.
Porque si quieres comértela con placer.
Because if you want to eat it and enjoy it, make it pleasurable, because it might be a really good apple, there might be some gastronomy aptitude there.
Pero si esta misma manzana.
But if you were to put that very same apple on a plate.
Para mí esto es cocinar.
For me, that's cooking. And in that very fine line right there, that's where we could say that cooking really starts. Because cooking is transforming the food to make it more pleasurable. So when did cooking start? So I mean, when did it really start? Was it 2.5 million years ago when the Homo habilis came? Or when did it really
start?
Or did it actually start a million years ago with fire?
¿Cuándo empezó?
When did it really start?
¿Cuándo podríamos cocinar más o menos parecido a hoy?
When was it that we were able to cook mostly in a similar way as we cook nowadays?
¿Cómo podría hervir, freír?
How could you boil? How could you fry? How could you stew?
La cerámica.
Ceramic.
Hace muy poco.
Not very long
8,000
ago. 8,000 years ago.
Sí, una sola tecnología.
A technology.
La de hacer,
the one that you use to make these containers.
Muy simple.
It's very simple. ¿No? Right?
Cambió la historia de la gastronomía.
But that's what changed the history of gastronomy.
Tanto como el fuego.
Just as much as fire did.
Ajá.
You are known for transforming the world of food. But how do you define your food and your cooking?
Well, first of all, the most important part about Bulli is that we have made people think.
En relación con la cocina.
In relation to cuisine and gastronomy.
Tenemos claro que hay que comer productos naturales, ¿no?
It's pretty clear that we're supposed to eat organic food, right?
No, organic no.
No, natural, I'm sorry, natural food.
Natural food, okay? Mm-hmm. Y que un tomate orgánico. Vale,
and so it's clear that an organic tomato is a supernatural food, right? ¿No? Product, right?
¿Sí?
Right?
Mentira.
That's a lie, though.
Esto es objetivo. Por esto cuando
la this is objective.
Natural es lo que está en la naturaleza sin que
so something natural is something that's in nature, but the human being has not touched it, though.
El tomate natural está en los Andes.
The natural tomato is up in the Andes.
Es incomestible.
And that one you cannot eat.
Es malísimo.
It's super bad.
El 99% de los
99% of the natural vegetables are not edible.
El tomate orgánico
the organic
es lo menos
tomato
natural.
Is the least natural thing in the entire world.
Porque se ha hecho,
because ¿vale? it has been made, right? I mean, man has participated to make it a better product.
Esto es lo que hizo el Bulli.
So that's what Bulli did.
Okay, so I have a question about el Bulli. People consider those meals amazing, their most memorable meals ever, the idea of having 20 to 40 courses. And I guess I want to ask Ferran what he wanted his diners to come away with from that experience.
Well, first of all, Bulli was probably the first restaurant in history that had people that hated it. Why? Because we took that experience to the limit.
El Bulli cocinaba para abrir caminos.
We cooked to open new paths.
Y hacerte reflexionar.
And to make you reflect on things.
Y estabas un promedio de cinco horas
you would
sentado.
Spend an average of 5 hours sitting down at Buyi.
Y a veces seis, ¿eh?
And sometimes even six.
Pero no comiendo todo el tiempo.
But it wasn't just always eating all the time.
Pero, tú, fíjate, seis horas viendo
Can you imagine
museo?
Spending six
seis
hours watching a movie or at a museum? 6 hours.
Y con un nivel de concentración muy, muy alto.
And with a very, very high level of concentration.
Claro, hacía que, y hace que el Buyi
This song
muy,
makes
the,
made Buyi a very strange thing. We could spend another whole hour talking about strange things at
Buyi.
So, I mean, really, without context, people might think these guys are crazy. But no, we were actually the most logical people that you could ever imagine. And with the foundation, we're following the same path now. And the whole thing, it's about asking ourselves, why, and why?
So you did not dream of becoming a chef. You didn't particularly love to cook or love to eat. And here you are, and your brother is a brilliant chef as well. How'd you get here?
It just happened, but it's a great reflection.
And
the fact that it happened to my brother Albert, too, that's amazing, too.
Seguramente hay pocas personas.
And there are probably very, very few people that in their discipline have had such a strange career.
Porque normalmente alguien empieza una disciplina
because normally you start in one discipline and you work really hard so you can go really far.
Nosotros no.
We didn't.
Un año.
We started cooking thinking that we would last a year.
Siempre el porqué de las cosas.
And maybe that's why we always ask ourselves why about things.
Yo mismo sé contestar esta pregunta.
But it is true that even myself, I'm not able to answer this question. Hmm.
It was such a pleasure to meet you and speak with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ferran Adria's Notes on Creativity was at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. Now, for more information about the exhibition and Ferran's El Buyi Foundation, head to our website, splendidtable.org. Chef Michael Solomonov has spent his life living and traveling between two countries, Israel and the United States. With strong roots in both places, he's become a leading interpreter of Israeli food. Americans flock to his restaurant, Zav, in Philadelphia for the authentic dishes of Israel, but also, as he explains to our contributor, Patty Hinnich, they come for the style of what it means to eat Israeli.
Michael, so lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on the show. It's great to talk to you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your connection to Israel?
You know, I was born there and I grew up here in the States. And then when I was 15 or so, we moved back to Israel. I stayed for a year and went to a boarding school there and then moved back to the States and then dropped out of college and moved back to Israel for a year. And that's where I learned how to cook. So I worked in like a little bakery and then I worked in a cafe. And then I went to culinary school in the States. And that's it. Over time, I just think that cooking and being interested in Israeli cuisine, it's sort of grounded me a little bit. Israeli food is represents all the people that make up Israel. So there's Iraqi, Iranians, North Africans, Yemeni, Greek, Cyprus, Bulgaria, Romania, all of Europe.
Can you define any common denominator that would describe, or explain to a foreigner what Israeli food is, given that there's so much diversity within it?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple sort of principles. Mm-hmm. And of course, there are exceptions to all of these, but the heavy use of tahina throughout Israel is very, very important because tahina was sort of the way to sauce meat without being non-kosher, right?
Oh,
so if
right.
you add like yogurt or if you add like any other dairy product or cheese, it's like you can't, you don't really serve meat with it. So that one thing, the heavy use of tahina, the indigenous olive oil, the bitter herbs and the spices that sort of make up, cooking in that region. But I mean, cuisine is in motion all the time, whether we sort of know it or not. It's always sort of changing. It's always evolving. People are adapting and transporting and, sort of transcending food. So it's really difficult Especially in a place like Israel, which is sort of like the cultural crossroads for many different people. It's hard to pinpoint a few things that make up Israeli food. We always joke in the kitchen whenever somebody asks me to taste something, they're like, what's it need? Olive oil, lemon, and parsley? You know?
Cause,
yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot of that, you know.
Right.
Israeli food is very vegetable forward, very vegetable heavy.
Right.
You know, not relying, you know, entirely on like tons of proteins. So
right.
I don't know.
I had the opportunity to eat at your restaurant recently with my husband and my boys, and the moment we walked in, we felt like a feasting and feast environment. So the way the food is served and everything is shared, and there's some like contagious enthusiasm and happiness and generosity about the way the food is served and how it's shared. Do you think that describes or defines a little bit the Israeli way of approaching food?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sort of a mentality in which you eat. The spirit of sort of rolling up the sleeves and breaking bread together is something that we try to emulate at the restaurant. We want the customers to feel that. We want you, you know, we want to make memories. And I mean, food, of course, has to be very good. It's not. It's about the company. It's about the style in which you eat. It's about the holiday that you share. It's about the traditions. You know, I think that you know, eating is such a huge ceremony.
Absolutely, and
for everybody. I mean, it's common.
Yeah. So you're the perfect person to talk to about how to put together a feast. How do you like to set the table, and what you like to put on the table?
Well, I think cooking and dining is festive, right? So I like things that are bright and not just like aesthetically bright, you know, like our sort of like turmeric stained pickles, but, you know, the sweet and the sour, you know, and sort of the vegetables. I want it to look like a party. So I like a bunch of little salatim, whether that's like raw tabbouleh, you know, chopped parsley salad, sort of like a stewed tomato compote called matbucha, you know, which kind of goes with everything, or eaten by itself, bowls of hummus and piles of sort of bread or pita or laffa, you know, the fluffy sort of Iraqi pita, and then bowls of like different pilafs or grains, or, you know, bowls of Israeli couscous or Moroccan couscous or Persian rice that's sort of fragrant with saffron and dried fruit and almonds. And then, you know, I like the whole sort of lamb shoulder that's been glazed with pomegranate. Whole roasted chicken, also sitting on laffa, this puffy sort of Iraqi-style pita, you know, with tahina sauce and pickles and whole fish, too. We wrap whole fish with grape leaves and then grill it. And I don't know, I just think that that sort of way is fun to eat. You know, people rolling up their sleeves and sort of bumping elbows and sharing pieces of bread or passing things and taking little bites and even double dipping sometimes with your spoons and forks, to me, is a good party. That's what it should be. I don't like things to be overly refined, and certainly not in my house.
Michael, it was so great to talk with you today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Michael Solomonov is the author of Zav, A World of Israeli Cooking. Patty Hinnich is host of Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. Now, Michael left us with some centerpiece recipes to plan a feast around. Find his recipe for Zahav lamb shoulder and whole fish wrapped in grape leaves. Doesn't that sound sensational? It's all at SplendidTable.org, with lots of other holiday menu ideas. So do a little browsing on the website. That's SplendidTable.org. You know all those classic English scenes where the ladies retire to the drawing room after dinner while the men stay at the table smoking cigars and drinking port? Well, all those genteel English women were not missing out on the cigars, but they were certainly missing out on that port. To my mind, port is one of the most overlooked wines, and if ever there was a time of year to track some down, this is it. Our contributor Noel Carter sat down with award-winning wine writer Karen McNeil to find out exactly what we need to know.
Karen, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, Noel.
You know, now that we're in the thick of the holiday season, port seems to be one of those things that's perfectly suited to this time of year. For those of us that are new to port, could you explain what it is and where it comes from?
Yes, port is a fortified sweet wine that comes from northern Portugal, specifically from the Douro River Valley. And that's the only place in the world where true port is made.
And what is it fortified with?
It's fortified, Noelle, with natural grape spirits. So they are, it's really like a clear brandy that is added during the making of the port to raise the alcohol level just a little bit. And often those spirits are made with the very same grapes that the port itself is made from. Port is very delicious, but it takes a little bit of understanding before you buy it because, depending on how you count, there's anywhere from 6 to 10 major styles. Shall I tell you about the two top styles, though?
That would be wonderful.
Yes, because I think it's probably true for any of us today if you're going to have this, a bottle of port for Christmas or the holidays. You're probably going to focus on either tawny port or vintage port. And here's the key question you have to ask yourself. Would you rather have creme brulee or would you rather have chocolate cake? Because tawny port has flavors very similar to creme brulee, all that sort of caramel, brown sugar, cream, custard, those sorts of flavors. Whereas vintage port is very chocolatey, very berry, very deep and complex in the way that dark chocolate is. So those two main styles of port are radically different, and they are both delicious. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that makes it so fascinating and fabulous during a holiday meal is that it often is the perfect way to end a big, rich meal. So maybe instead of dessert or just one little bite of, your favorite holiday pie, a small glass of port is so sumptuous. And it can have all those flavors.
It just sounds wonderful. I can't wait to go out and pick up a bottle or two for gift giving. Are there any particular labels that you might recommend? And how much should I plan on spending for, say, a decent bottle of port?
Well, for a tawny port, probably we're talking about $35 to $50. And remember, usually people serve small amounts of port, no more than 2 ounces, because it is so concentrated. So a bottle of port is going to serve 12 people. So one bottle will, in fact, go a long way. With vintage port, because vintage port is the top port and it is often given as a gift, I think you should count on anywhere from $100 to $200 or sometimes more if you buy already a very old vintage.
Are there any particular names or labels that that you would recommend?
Yes, I love the ports of Graham's, Dow's, Wars, Taylor Fladgate, very famous vintage ports that are delicious. And then smaller producers like Quinta do Vesuvio. When you see the word Quinta, it translates to farm in Portuguese, but it means that the wine came from one very small prestigious estate. So Quinta do Vesuvio's vintage ports are also phenomenal. Smith Woodhouse. In fact, there aren't all that many great port firms left. They've consolidated over the years. And the ones that we get here in the United States are almost uniformly the very top ones. So luckily, you almost can't make, in fact, I would say you cannot make a mistake. Any true port from Portugal on a shelf in the United States is, in fact, one of the 20 great brands in the world.
That's great to know. Now, let's say for some strange reason, I don't finish the bottle of port at the night that I serve it. How long will a bottle keep after it's opened?
Port will last quite a long time. If it's tawny port, it will last, easily a month or more, 3, 4, sometimes even 5 months. Vintage port, it depends on how old the wine is that you're serving. If you're serving a wine from the 80s, it would probably last a week maybe. If you are lucky enough to have a really old, wonderful port, like the famous 1970 version, vintage port, that probably is only going to last a day because the older the wine is, the more frail it is. But here's an important point. Even when you may not want to drink the port, if you have a little bit left in the bottle, it is absolutely phenomenal to cook with. So
really?
Even when port is past its prime for drinking, it is still wonderful at layering flavor into all kinds of dishes and stews and soups.
Wonderful. Karen, thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Karen McNeil's latest book is an update of her classic, The Wine Bible. Noelle Carter is the Los Angeles Times Test Kitchen Director and writes the Culinary SOS column. Now, you can find Karen's port picks and an excerpt from her port chapter at splendidtable.org. Coming up, we can talk. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, it's time to turn to your calls. Get to us at 800-537-5252. And remember, we're on Facebook and Twitter, and you can send us an email, splendidtable.org. Nicole is calling from Portland, Oregon. Nicole, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to talk about a Christmas gift for my mom. She is an excellent cook, and my dad tipped us off that she would really like recommendations or to get a couple of cookbooks from both of her daughters that are basically addressing lamb. She's never really cooked with lamb.
Uh-huh.
And she got a Dutch oven last year for Christmas from us. And she wants also not only sort of cookbooks about lamb, but also maybe sauces to go to accompany with them, or just sort of generally meat dishes. And I was thinking about, there's so many different options, right? There's Mediterranean lamb, which is different from Middle Eastern or Indian. And I have no idea where to begin and just would love your recommendation on kind of what kind of global sauce books or best lamb books. Give me some help.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And I'm just trying to think. I can't offhand think of a book that focuses on lamb, you know, something done with a lot of thought and a lot of work. But there are some excellent meat books out there. Anything by Chris Slazenger and John Willoughby, and they've done they did a big book on meat, which she will find handy. I mean, the lamb information is going to be dynamite, but the rest of it's going to be great too, because it's about how it's cut, how to identify it, how to handle it, what do you stew, what do you bake, you know, what do you roast.
Oh, that sounds perfect.
It's a great, you know, it's sort of your meat guide, a basic book for the kitchen.
That sounds wonderful. Yeah,
yeah. That's one approach. And there may not be a ton of lamb recipes in there, but generally remember something. Almost anything you can do with beef, you can do with lamb, but you're going to cook it a shorter time just because the lamb is smaller. So, I mean, if you see, if there's a recipe that looks like it's just utterly delicious for a beef stew, it could easily be a lamb stew.
Okay.
And if it calls for chuck, which is the shoulder of the steer, and you would see this because they have diagrams, that is lamb shoulder.
Ah.
What's a chop on a lamb is a steak on a steer.
Perfect.
You
That's
see what
such a great, yeah.
And by the way, Bruce Idells, Aidells, also has done a great meat book.
Great.
Okay, so can't find lamb itself, but these are going to be things that are going to give her a lot of information.
Well,
about
that's
what
wonderful.
She's, yeah,
I
she'll
think
have
that,
the
that's
basics.
That's what she wants. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're making my Christmas. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Take care.
Appreciate it.
Bye. You can reach us on Facebook and Twitter. And if you want to, you can send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Tim's on the line from Anderson, Missouri. Tim, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi there. Well, I've been raising geese this year.
Ooh.
I've never cooked one. And I can cook a little bit, but I really want to knocked the socks off my family this year.
Oh, boy. Raising geese. Oh, my. Are they hard to raise? I understand they can be quite. I mean, the geese I've met personally, some of them have not been the friendliest of creatures.
Well, yeah, they chased my brother-in-law around the yard.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's actually funny because they kind of try to take a bite out of him, but he's just waiting to take a bite out of one of them.
Well, now he can get his wish. Okay, this is the deal. There's a lot of fat on a goose. But believe it or not, the meat can dry out. So what you want to do is cook it low and slow. And then if the skin has not crisped, then you can flip up the oven to get that skin really crispy and crunchy.
But I had a question.
Sure.
We have an electric inside oven, but I also have a big hood on my outside grill. Would it be better to do it that way?
Well,
Better heat that way, I'm thinking.
You think the heat's more even on the grill than in the oven?
Yeah.
Then I think that's the best way to go. But you're going to have to keep it pretty low. So you want it at about 300, 325. And this is the thing you want to do because there's usually a fair amount of fat in the breast. And a little bit of that's not a bad thing. And there's also a fair amount of fat in the back. When you get the goose cleaned and whatever, remove the fat pockets from the tush, as we say, of the goose.
Right.
And there's usually some pockets of it in the neck. Now, don't throw that out. That's pure gold for cooking. I mean, just fabulous. Oh yeah.
Okay.
Anything you saute in goose fat is going to be wonderful. Potatoes will make you just plots from happiness. But the thing you want to do then is you want to make just little pricks with a point of a knife into the skin, in the breast, in the back. Don't go all the way down into the meat. You just want to prick so that there's a way of some of that fat draining off.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Like a release valve.
And then what you can do is rub it with a bit of salt and pepper, okay? And whatever seasoning you like. I love garlic. And
we do too.
Yeah.
We go crazy for garlic.
Yeah. And I think that, and you could have some lemon, and you could have whatever herb you like. You know, it's some of the things that are lovely with goose are things like rosemary and oranges. But when you season that goose, put it in the fridge overnight. So that seasonings can permeate it a little bit. And then put it in a shallow roasting pan. You want it to be about 2 to 3 inches high. Okay. And you're going to put some water or broth or even wine in the bottom of the pan. I always favor wine. Apple cider could work, a combination of white wine.
No, we've got some beautiful cooking wine from California. We do long-haul delivery, me and my wife.
Oh, you do? Oh.
We've got some great stuff from Sonoma. So, and it's been just sitting there, and I don't know what to do with it. So that's what we're doing.
But the point, this is the thing. What you want to do is put it on a rack so the fat drips away. Okay?
Okay.
Put it on a rack and start out with it breast down. And
breast down,
right.
Okay.
And then what you do is you put a little liquid, like about a half inch to an inch of liquid in the bottom. No more.
Okay.
And to make an interesting pan sauce, you can throw in some celery and carrot and chopped up onion if you want and a bit of garlic. But the idea there is you want the fat to be dripping down into that pan. And you're going to roast it, start it at 400 for about 30 minutes, flip it down to about 325, and figure about 15 minutes to the pound. Baste it periodically, and about halfway through cooking, pull it out of the oven, use heavy mitts or heavy, folded up kitchen towels, and flip it over so it's breast up. And you know it's done when you stick an instant reading thermometer, which is pure gold in the kitchen, into the thickest part of the thigh, because that's usually where the meat is the thickest, and you get a reading of about 165. Now, the big trick after that is let it rest on a platter for about 20 minutes. Skim off all the fat that you can and save the fat from the pan juices. And then you can throw a little bit more wine into that. Boil it until it's thick and delicious. And if you want to thicken it with a mixture of a little flour and water, a tablespoon of flour with about 4 or 5 tablespoons of cold water. You beat it in a glass so there's no lumps. And you pour that in and you boil until things thicken.
Wow. The geese are actually pretty easy to raise. It's a very good question. They're fun, but they're at the same time. They love my sister, but they run from me. I think they know the deal.
Yeah, they're very smart animals from what I've been told.
they protect the other. We have chickens, ducks, and geese, and they protect pretty much everything.
Really?
Yeah. My poor brother-in-law.
Well, yeah, from your brother-in-law, too. It's very interesting. Hey, Tim, you have a fabulous goose.
Thank you very much.
Enjoy. Enjoy.
I can't wait. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
We've got Jeremy calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Jeremy,
Hi, what's up?
Hello. What do you want to talk about?
I have some German Rumtopf in my basement right now.
Oh.
Not sure if you're familiar with that, but it's a concoction of seasonal fruit, sugar, and rum that I've been putting together since May of this year. So,
Yeah,
I spent some time in Germany, so I got turned on to this while I was there. And there are several cocktails and sweet preparations, but I'm trying to find a probably a vegetarian and a pork option for a savory preparation as well.
Mm. So you're saying taking the Rumtopf fruit mixture and turning it into a savory that could be served with something like pork.
Exactly. I'm thinking it would make a good sauce somehow, but I'm just unsure about where to move forward with that.
I understand. Yeah, because it's very, very sweet. Maybe you should explain exactly how it's done, because a lot of people haven't heard of it.
Sure. So it's basically using a crock, and you're adding seasonal fruit as it comes into season. So my concoction has strawberries, cherries, plums, peaches. I think there's one other thing that's in there as well. And you're just adding sugar and a high-proof rum to that each time you add a new layer. So,
and it ferments.
Exactly. This is my first effort, so I'm not entirely sure if it's supposed to be swimming in rum, but the fruit has really absorbed a lot of that. So it's more almost like a jelly or preserve-like.
Oh, my. And the lid has not blown off the top of the crock.
Not yet.
Okay. Well, I think you've got a couple of options. First of all, if you get some of that into a saucepan, you boil it down a bit. And then what you do is you could go, I mean, you could really go sweet tart and do boiled down vinegar. For instance, if you were to take a cup of vinegar and boil it down by at least half or two thirds, which mellows it, and then that goes in to about a cup and a half, 2 cups of your Rumtopf that you've cooked down already. And then you might add to that fresh ginger, black pepper, a bit of salt. Some people might even put in garlic. So you're making like a sweet, savory sauce for this. Grated orange or lemon rind to add a sparkle to it. And you feel your way through, because no two Rumtopfs are tasting alike.
Right.
But you want something acidic. You were looking at sweet tart now, so something acidic, but that you've softened by boiling it down.
Mm-hmm.
And then spices along with that you can cook in.
And I should mention, too, I've also added a stick of cinnamon and a couple of pods of star anise, too.
This is fabulous. You know what this is making me think of is Chinese cooking. Glazing a duck with the liquid, with that Rumtopf syrup and the addition of the vinegar, you could start brushing the duck toward the end of cooking so it glazes beautifully. And then using some of the fruit with short grain rice and a dash of soy sauce to make a steamed Chinese rice pudding. It's often called 8 treasure pudding. And I haven't made it in ages, but it comes out as this dome. And it can be sweet and savory, and it's just wonderful. But you could kind of do a takeoff on that. You steam rice and then toss it with that fruit and add maybe salted shelled pistachios and walnuts and that sort of thing. And then just heat that in the oven so it's fluffy and dry. And you serve the duck with that.
Yeah, that sounds like a winner.
I think that would really go over very well.
I've not experimented with duck before, so that'll be another part of the adventure there.
Yeah, with all those flavors, too. Think about this. Whenever you're making a pan sauce and you want to scrape up all those good bits and make a little bit of sauce, just take a little bit of that syrup with a bit of white wine or something that's dry. And you know, stir it in. It'll give you just that little hint. I think you can be nipping into that in small quantities and adding flavor to so many different things.
Well, I've got plenty of it, so there will be lots of experiments to come.
Okay, and you can keep adding to it, too, which is the great thing.
Absolutely.
Enjoy the rum talk.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
Take care, Jeremy.
Okay.
Well, that's it for the week. Thanks for joining us. You have a great week, and however you're celebrating, may it be a delight. Let me leave you with this thought from Hamilton Wright Mabey, who said, "Blessed is the season which engages the whole world in a conspiracy of love." SplendidTable.org has just about everything you will ever need. And if you love what you heard here today, be sure to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite podcast app. And for a daily dose of food inspiration, make sure you're following us on Instagram and Pinterest. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. You have a great week. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.